It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As part of our conversations about homelessness in Wisconsin, we take a closer look at barriers to get a toehold in the workforce. When access to a mailing address and the internet disappears, the job search process, it may necessitate online applications and virtual job interviews. Be part of this discussion at any point, calling in with a question, sharing your comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Gina Brown is Director of Operations at Workforce Connections. The La Crosse-based nonprofit assists with career planning, job searches, and skills training. Gina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, take us into how Workforce Connections helps people find jobs.
Workforce Connections is a nonprofit, and we do a number of programs that allow for people through the lifespan to be able to access different services. We see our job as really the connection to what resources people may need through their job search journey. We are able to provide services for where the individual needs them and meeting them when they walk through our door. Everybody has a different journey, and we want to be a part of that process. It may be making connections to other resources that they need or supports. It may be connecting them to educational opportunities. It may be helping them for the next step. And so really, we look at that individual as they walk through and try to help them be more successful and ultimately more self-sufficient for them and their families.
Extending this here, where is the connection most commonly broken?
You know, I think what we see is the people that we work with every day have a lot on their plate. The problems in today's society and our world are larger than they've ever been. And the chaos that exists within each and everybody's world is a lot. And we want to be able to piece back those layers to be able to determine what their individual situation is and how we can take those incremental steps forward for them. It could be in some cases housing, it could be food insecurity, it could be childcare, it could be relationships, there is just a multitude of things. And most times we see people with multiple things that they're working through.
You didn't mention transportation, and I'm just wondering how often that comes up, getting to and from a job, a potential job, is an obstacle.
Absolutely. Transportation is very high on our list as well. As a service provider in Western Wisconsin, a number of our communities are very rural in nature. And so the reality of what is available and where people live can very much impact their opportunities for transportation. We have some communities that have public transportation and, again, supports and resources that we can connect people to. But there is absolutely a huge disproportionate of need when it comes to transportation.
I just think about how the job search process has become so technology driven, you know, not only scrolling through job listings, but, you know, you have to fill out an online application. Someone is calling you back, perhaps emailing you back. What about computer access and ensuring, you know, these potential new hires are able to have that technology?
Absolutely. Technology has been something that has inundated us, and it has really changed the scope of business and employment in general. Part of our role is to really connect with the individuals that come to see us to find out where those resources are available in their community. Many libraries have free resources. We have a job center that is open to the public in La Crosse that does allow for access to be able to utilize technology. We work with our customers to see if there are services or opportunities for cell phones. We have opportunities at times for those individuals working with us to be able to utilize laptops and finding those connectivity spots. But it's even more than the connectivity. It's also the ability to have the technical knowledge of how to respond and how to monitor your email and the pieces to access not only the job application, but the follow-up process to that.
Oh, the digital literacy piece is also extremely important, as much as perhaps access.
Absolutely. And just, you know, how we respond and the tools that we want to use and the ability to practice some of those skills are really important. You kind of get one opportunity at times to get your foot in the door, and we want to make sure that our customers have that best foot forward. There's also many tools that employers utilize that can help them manage the applications coming in, but that also does impact how our participants will utilize technology, how they complete information, and sometimes their access or opportunity to even get their foot through the door.
Gina Brown with us works for a La Crosse-based workforce nonprofit as we examine the challenges of finding a job while experiencing homelessness. And you can join in along the way. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Martha in Menominee. Hi, Martha. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Say, I was wondering if Gina could talk about the crippling cost of childcare and how that affects particularly single parent homes and households and people who would like to have a single parent home, but childcare just seems to be one of the biggest stumbling blocks. And maybe Gina could talk about that.
Martha, thank you for that. Gina, go ahead.
Absolutely. Yes. The childcare crisis, not only in our state, but across the country, is really something that we've never seen. Not only the inability when we talk about the cost, the sheer cost for families and the ability to have the money to be able to sustain both working and having that be a win-win, but just the availability, being able to find quality, safe childcare that allows for parents to be able to focus on their employment goals. We know by working with our partner agencies, we are always better community-wise, being able to tag together and find out how we can kind of look at this on a much more systematic scale. But we also have to bring in our employer partners at this point. This is just so much bigger than any one of us, and it's really an opportunity for us to revisit what our priorities are in this state and in this nation to be able to not only help out our individuals to be productive in our communities, but also our kids to have the environment that they need to succeed.
Our team has talked with several people experiencing homelessness, and some said employers won't hire them because their address is a shelter. Do you ever hear similar concerns?
Absolutely. Not having kind of your basic needs met from a perspective of our customers, but also from then the perspective of an employer. And so we really want to be able to sit down with those individuals and we want to talk about what are those opportunities. Where else could that address be? Maybe you are staying at a shelter, but where could you safely receive mail? Do you have family? Do you have friends? Do we have members of a team that are helping to be able to allow for different opportunities? In some communities, people are able to utilize the Health and Human Services address as a mailing address. But we all know that, you know, certain addresses become knowledge to everybody, and then that does paint a certain picture. And we want to make sure that we've given everybody the opportunity to think through all of those relationships and opportunities that might be able to show the value that they bring to that employer.
Last month, one of our producers talked with Todd in Madison, who was experiencing homelessness, and Todd said they were first homeless in 2018 until a job center helped find them a job. But Todd also faced challenges maintaining long-term work.
For a 52-year-old man to do dishes ain't gonna work. So I ended up finding another job, which was Madison Taxi. I drove for them for 5.5, almost 6 years, and then I became homeless again in third week of June.
Gina, Todd said that they lost the taxi job because of personal mistakes. How does your organization support people seeking new jobs who have a bumpy employment history?
Yeah, you know, the people that come and work with us are all looking for kind of a new opportunity and a next step and starting over. And our role is to really focus on the next piece to that. As we look at opportunities, we want to look at each of their scenarios. We want to talk about what employers and what opportunities might be best for them. How can they explain where maybe their history has been and what their future could look like? We want to also, you know, realize from the employer standpoint that our employment world looks different than it ever did. And we need to be open to what are the opportunities to fill those gaps in the workforce. And we need to be more open to be able to look at second chances and opportunities. Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody has scenarios that they struggle through. And our world is to really look at how do we look at the next step forward for not only our individuals, but also our communities.
Gina Brown is operations director at the La Crosse-based nonprofit called Workforce Connections. As we discuss job searches and people experiencing housing insecurity, call in with a question or bring your views, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine what it's like to job hunt while struggling with homelessness without a reliable mailing address or access to technology that's part of the job search process, like scrolling through open positions and filling out an online application, conducting virtual job interviews. Call in with a question. Share your insights, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Gina Brown is here, operations director at Workforce Connections in La Crosse. Gina, how does Workforce Connections help people with disabilities find work?
You know, I think that goes back to the conversation that we talked about before about, you know, everybody having a different journey through their employment. We will meet that person and look at what opportunities we can connect them to. We also want to make sure that we have the right team connected and we're all working toward the same goal. That could include a medical team, a mental health team. That may include the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. We want to make sure all of those partners are around the same table and working toward the goals that that individual has. It may be part-time, it may be full-time. There's a gamut of things that could be available, but we really want to be able to look at what they bring to the table and sell those skills to be able to allow them to be a part of the community as well.
A couple times here, you've used the word customer. Why do you call the people you help customers?
You know, we're providing a service. We really see our customers twofold at Workforce Connections. We have the people that come in, individuals that really are looking to seek services as it relates to employment and training. But on the other side, we're really a connection to the employment world, and we see the employers as our customers as well. We're there to be able to make those connections for them between the world of work, the skills, and the opportunities, and be able to funnel those together in hopes that as a community, we're able to fill that employment gap.
Madison's mayor, Satya Rhodes-Conway, joined us on the show this week to discuss how Madison is addressing homelessness. And Mayor Rhodes-Conway said housing insecurity is connected to income.
The minimum wage in Wisconsin and across the country hasn't gone up in a very long time. Another way to address housing insecurity is to raise the minimum wage, to raise wages across the board, and give people more financial security so they can afford housing.
Gina, Wisconsin's minimum wage being $7.25 an hour, the National Low Income Housing Coalition says our residents working minimum wage can afford a rent of $377 a month. Are employers offering wages above the minimum wage?
You know, post-COVID, when we really kind of look at wages, I mean, our minimum wage is obviously a continued issue. And I think the mayor has a very good point. And if we really do the math, and if any of us look in the newspaper in our communities for housing at $300 a month, we all know that those housings do not exist. We have seen an increase in wage opportunity, but we've also seen an increase in just the cost of living, cost of goods. Though we've seen that increase in wage, we've also seen the increase in all of our housing opportunities for anyone in all of our even small communities in rural Wisconsin. And so though wages do impact it, we're really not seeing the balancing or that step up that allows for people to have enough money at the end of the day to meet their basic needs. And we're talking about very basic housing, clothing, food. I mean, those three pieces to be able to even focus on the next step and stabilize is still in a dire strait.
in a dire strait. I wonder, in the La Crosse area where you are, do you find that there is a shortage of low-income housing in the area that could help to fill a need and be a reason at a reasonable cost?
Absolutely. We always are in need of additional low-income housing, and just the ability to be able to attach people to the opportunities. I mean, the people that are in need and the customers that we serve, as we talked about, have kind of been through journeys and have struggles, and that all impacts even their ability to be able to access some of those resources and those services. And again, we go back to childcare and or housing, just the availability of affordable opportunities in all of our communities are just not there for the people that we want to be able to connect.
So statewide, a Wisconsin household needs to earn at least $34,000 to afford a one-bedroom apartment at fair market rent, and that, again, from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. What qualifications, what skills do people typically need to secure a job above minimum wage?
Again, post-COVID, as we look at wages, employers have had to look at their competitiveness and have had made some changes to that. And, you know, historically, we maybe didn't have the opportunity with some of the entry-level jobs at the wages that we're seeing today. But employers today, as much as there are certain jobs that need a diverse skill set and need to have specific certifications and education, a number of employment opportunities really are looking for people that are able to come to work daily, on time, show up, ready to learn, those soft skills of being able to work with different people, open to training, open to learning, positive attitude, constructive criticism, and really want to be there to be part of something, and finding a culture that they fit into. Those opportunities are still out there and really open the doors to kind of that next step.
We're talking about the challenges of finding a job while homeless. Gina Brown works for a La Crosse-based workforce agency. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Gina, Marie in Eau Claire called in to ask, are there any programs like yours in the Eau Claire area?
Yeah, actually, Workforce Connections, being a nonprofit, provides services that are both funded at the federal and state level. And there are similar services throughout all of the state of Wisconsin. You have the opportunity to look at local job centers that are located throughout Wisconsin that have multitude of services located right in their buildings. And there is a job center in La Crosse or in Eau Claire. Further, there are a number of different services that are available and funded through the Department of Health Services, the Department of Children and Families, and all of those services are statewide and free.
More than 2,500 people living in La Crosse County have filed an unemployment insurance claim since January. That's from the State Department of Workforce Development. Do state unemployment benefits, do you think they provide enough support to people facing housing insecurity?
The housing costs and the rate of cost for housing right now is, again, the highest that we've seen. And our unemployment rates, aside from during COVID, have really stayed stagnant for a very long time. And I think any one of us that would be in a situation where our lives had changed would struggle very much to be able to maintain our living and our housing opportunities with the current opportunities for unemployment. There really is a need to very quickly re-engage in the workforce and find out how to connect to be able to support and stabilize with or without unemployment benefits.
Turning our attention to younger people, this week Governor Tony Evers announced a record number of participants in the state's youth apprenticeship program, more than 16,000 apprentices enrolled. How do you see this program benefiting teens?
You know, we serve our customers, for the most part, adults, but we do have the opportunity to serve families, and that includes all of the youth associated with them. And we do have a small youth program. We, again, need to reimagine where our workforce is coming from and how we best capture that. And that really starts in our school systems. We talk about how we prepare our middle schoolers and our high schoolers for the next level and giving them the map and the opportunities of what's really out there. You know, there's obviously four-year colleges and opportunities with that. There is a magnitude of two-year degrees and technical degrees and certifications, and apprenticeship is huge. We really need to look at how do we best connect not only our youth with the education and opportunities, but their families to understand what's really out there, where do they want to start, and how do we build that into our workforce today? Apprenticeship is been, you know, a huge opportunity here in Wisconsin. And I think we're going to continue to see that as we try to fill those gaps for employment. And employers, again, are trying to be more creative with how they engage their communities and their workforce.
And so you really have to look, as you mentioned, at all age groups across the spectrum of life to really look at different workforce needs.
I think that's the only way as we, you know, in the state, in this nation, in this, in our, you know, independent communities, really try to bridge the gap and find out how do we all solve some of these big standing systematic problems together.
Gina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate the opportunity.
Gina Brown is Operations Director at Workforce Connections in La Crosse. The morning show here, we're producing a range of conversations about homelessness. I hope you've been able to catch them. You can find links to recent segments in this ongoing coverage. Share all of your program ideas on housing. Connect with us, WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Department of Public Instruction releases report cards this week to give a glimpse at how our state's public schools are doing. Wisconsin Public Radio's education reporter Corrine Hess is here to help explain these scores that judge the performance of school districts, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Bring your comments. The number to call in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Corey, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So this week, DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, releases these report cards showing that 83% of Wisconsin's public schools met or exceeded expectations. How does this figure compare to previous years? Put this in context.
It's down slightly, not much. Last year, 84% of schools met expectations, and the year before, 87% were meeting expectations.
And when you say meeting expectations, what are these report cards scoring schools on?
Well, the report cards look at four priority areas: achievement, growth, target group outcomes, and if students are on track to graduate.
And they also look at multiple years, is that right?
That is right. And it's kind of hard just to look at, you know, these scores, like we're talking about meeting expectations. So, for example, Milwaukee Public Schools, Green Bay, and Madison all met expectations. They all got 3 stars, but they all really are doing very differently. So, for example, only about 14% of Milwaukee Public School students are proficient in reading, compared to 41% of Madison students. So, you know, it's hard to just look at the ratings themselves and make a determination of how a school district is doing, because there's so much data that goes into these report cards. They're several pages long. So if you really want to know how your school or how your district is doing, it's good to read the whole report card. I mentioned achievement and growth, and those are weighted differently for school districts, especially school districts like Milwaukee, where there's more economically disadvantaged students.
So what you're saying here, I think, is that these report cards are complex and the inputs are weighted differently for different districts, because if you see such a wide disparity in reading, that wouldn't be like the same type of comparison then.
That's right. So, you know, I mean, some conservative groups took issue with 94% of the state's school districts are meeting expectations, which, you know, it's like, well, so almost all the districts in the state are are doing well then, but you know, there are some issues. Some schools and districts are still struggling, and for different reasons. And so, you know, I just think that it's good to dig down and look at different things, different areas of what's going on in the schools.
Are there particular school districts that appear to be having greater challenges?
Well, I mean, I think all school districts have their own unique challenges, you know? I mean, the urban school districts have different challenges than rural school districts. And so, like I said, I think it's important to look at your individual school and your individual district, not just the stars that they get.
this year's report cards show more private schools being graded by the Department of Public Instruction. How are private schools performing compared to public schools?
Well, it's kind of hard, too, to compare private and public schools because most private schools don't get report cards. So DPI only makes report cards for private schools that get public funding through the voucher program, and only the private schools that have enough students taking standardized tests. So there are more this year. I think about 400 private schools got report cards. Last year, it was less than 200. And of those, about 80% met or exceeded state expectations. And that's down from about 87% last year.
Absenteeism is a concern on this set of report cards. The State Education Department is tracking this rise and how often students are absent more than 10% of possible attendance days. How concerned are state education leaders about this rise?
Well, they're very concerned. So we've done some reporting on this, and the new absentee numbers won't come out until March of 2024. But what we have already that from last year is nearly a quarter of students at both private and public schools missed at least a month of school, which is it's a ton of school to miss. And so both educators and politicians want to do something about this. DPI has made this a priority. They're using federal dollars to work with educators. And Speaker Robin Voss has formed a task force to look at this issue.
What are the barriers that kids face in attendance? I mean, what strategies will the Department of Public Instruction discuss with districts?
Well, I think they're working with individual districts to find out what those barriers are. In talking to Milwaukee Public Schools, I mean, there's a lot of barriers. There's mental health issues in families. There's poverty. There's crime. There's a lot of factors that go into to people's lives that are keeping kids from getting to school. I think sometimes you think like kids just don't want to go to school, but I think it's a lot more complex than that. So I believe, you know, DPI and educators and politicians are trying to get to the bottom of that.
How does this report card, you know, when you talk about multiple years in this report card, how does it compare to pre-pandemic levels of achievement for schools?
They're still not back to pre-pandemic levels. But this report card was the first one that did not have the pre-pandemic years.
Oh.
So we're finally past. We're finally getting past that.
But the Department of Public Instruction, I continually hear it say that they are still in recovery mode. And from your analysis as an education reporter, what does that really mean?
I think when they say that, they mean that things were not perfect before the pandemic, and they've repeatedly said they don't want to go back to everything before the pandemic because they recognize, you know, things weren't perfect then either. There's disparities, you know, there's racial disparities and other disparities that they hope to keep working on.
Corrine Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio's education reporter, bringing us the latest in education news around the state. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at any point. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in on the latest in Wisconsin schools, their accountability, their funding, their oversight. With WPR's education reporter, Corrine Hess is here tracking developments. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in along the way to ask a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Michael from Menominee Falls. Hi, Michael. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, good morning. I think the data that we get about the schools is great. Helps us see where the gaps are, where to improve, areas to focus on. But I also would like to see the administrators, the teachers, the students, of course, but also the parents. I think we should have grading systems for all of those groups of people and systems behind the school system. Because if the parents aren't engaged, it's very, very hard to get a good education. And I don't see anywhere where the parents are graded. And I have, I know some educators, and this is one of the most common themes I hear for problems in the classroom. Kids, it's not necessarily they don't want to learn, but they're not encouraged to learn. And I think we need to grade the parents.
Michael, thank you for that. And Corrine, taking that more holistic look at how a child is learning and the involvement of parents, what do you find through your reporting?
I do think a lot of the more successful schools do have a lot of parent involvement, Michael, so that's a great point.
I want to turn now, Corey, to Milwaukee Public Schools, cutting off funding to a nonprofit called Milwaukee Education Partnership due to questions about what the organization has done with its funding. What are the concerns here?
Well, there were several concerns. So last week we did some reporting and we found that the executive director, Gerard Randall, was paid last year more than $64,000 for work that was not completed. And school board members had been expressing some concern about other services that the partnership was providing that may have been duplicate of things being done in the district. We also found that the Milwaukee Education Partnership's tax forms and website listed several high-profile officials that as board members without their knowledge. This included the Milwaukee mayor, state superintendent, and others. And so, Gerard Randall was questioned, and his answers have been vague.
And so what occurred last night at the school board meeting?
So last night at the school board meeting, there was a resolution to put on hold any more dealings with this group and until an investigation could be done. And kind of in a surprise move, Superintendent Keith Posley said he had reviewed all the contracts and he was going to stop. He was not going to do anything else with them. And so this decade-long partnership is now done. And, there was $75,000 set aside in this year's budget for the Milwaukee Education Partnership. So next month, they're going to come back and decide where to reallocate this money.
The nonprofit has received nearly $1.3 million in no-bid contracts from Milwaukee Public Schools over the past decade. How was the nonprofit supposed to be helping to improve test scores and teacher retention?
Well, when this started, it actually started about 20 years ago, and it kind of fizzled out, and then it was restarted 10 years ago with Mr. Randall. But when it started, it was supposed to be working with business groups and colleges, and just kind of, it was really kind of important at the time when it started. And it included the Milwaukee Chamber of Commerce, UWM, MATC, several high-profile groups. But over the years, all of them have ended their affiliation with the Milwaukee Education Partnership. And so I think that's why the school board became concerned, because they realized that Milwaukee Public Schools was sort of the last man standing here.
And there was concern, I understand, over the language in the contract between Milwaukee Public Schools and Milwaukee Education Partnership. What language was garnering criticism?
Well, yes, this school board member, Missy Zambor, she's new to the school board, and she kind of just started examining this and noticed that the language is pretty broad, and so there was no checks and balances. And when she looked into it further, she found that this group's website was out of date. Reports hadn't been updated since 2017. Like I brought up before, these tax forms and other documents listed people that were no longer with the group. And so she began asking some questions.
We're talking about recent education news in Wisconsin. Corey Hess with us, Wisconsin Public Radio's education reporter. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Will it ever be known what Gerard Randall has done with the money over the years? Will there be an investigation?
You know, I'm not sure. Yesterday, he really declined to talk to me for any story.
Officially on the record.
Okay. Officially on the record, yeah. He sent a few emails. But yesterday before the board meeting, he sent an email through a representative saying he's proud of the work he's done, that he did connect young people with educational and professional opportunities. He said that the school board did not give him an opportunity to share the work he's done, and he called the previous reporting misleading and that it painted an inaccurate and incomplete picture.
So trying to defend what the partnership has done. Any idea whether it could be forced to refund the district of any of the money it's received?
You know, I talked to school board member Missy Zambor when I was doing earlier reporting about it, and she wasn't sure. I don't know, other than that $64,000 for the work that was not done, if there would be any. I don't think that they're to that point yet.
Okay, and in our final moments here together, Menominee Falls High School removing 33 books from its library. How are community members and authors responding to a book ban there?
Most people are not happy in Menominee Falls about this. One of the authors, Jody Pico, whose book 19 Minutes about a School Shooting was banned, she's reached out to the school administrators for an explanation, and she's not gotten a response. So the families, the community members are pretty upset, but the school superintendent, school board president are being pretty quiet about it.
So far, no news on that front, but we'll keep watching it. Corey, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
Corinne Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio's education reporter, and you can visit our program page to stream, to download more programs. Also, if you have an idea for education or another topic, what the morning show should cover next, just get in touch with us. Email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.